Originally, the Unitarian and the Universalist sides of our heritage were theologically liberal branches of Protestant Christianity that emphasized Jesus' life, his teachings, his ethics. They increasingly taught that Jesus wanted others not to worship him, but to follow him and his way of self-giving love in their own time and place. As our UU slogans go, we're a religion of deeds, not creeds, and of salvation not by intellectual assent to beliefs, but salvation by character. We are saved from ourselves by how we treat others, as opposed to salvation, as the Red Queen once told Alice, by believing six impossible things before breakfast. As the Unitarians and the Universalists grew closer and eventually consolidated in 1961 to form the Unitarian Universalist Association, they also became an increasingly big tent. The original emphasis on a theologically liberal version of Jewish and Christian teachings expanded into the six sources that we know today, the seven principles and the six sources that we list on the back of each Sunday's order of service. Additionally, I've heard the argument made that we should perhaps add a seventh source, our Unitarian Universalist history and heritage. We're much more than a newfangled religion that started in the 60s. Not that there's anything wrong with things that started in the 60s. But it's significant to recognize that the roots of our Unitarian heritage go back to the 1500s in Europe, and that our Universalist heritage goes back to the 1700s, right here in North America, to the Jersey Shore, if you're curious. Our theological ancestors courageously demanded that the Bible be interpreted in light of reason, cutting-edge scholarship, and what they knew to be true in their own firsthand experience. And it's no coincidence that the Protestant Reformation were actually part of what is known as the radical part of the Protestant Reformation, that it began in the 1500s, barely 50 years after Johannes Gutenberg invented the mechanical moving type printing press, such that people finally had the Bible in their own hands that they could read and interpret for themselves. And what they discovered conflicted with centuries of tradition, creeds, and liturgy. Likewise, going back to the 1700s in North America, at that time, there was widespread anxiety about whether certain individuals were predestined to be tormented in the next life for all of eternity. And in the midst of, you know, Jonathan Edwards preaching sinners in the hands of an angry God, what some people have said was actually God in the hands of angry sinners, our Universalist ancestors began preaching a message of universal salvation for all people based on love, and eventually moved the focus to, you know, from a universal salvation for all people in the next world to a universal salvation right here and now with people like Clara Barton founding the Red Cross, saying what we really need to do is love the hell out of this world. So while I deeply appreciate our six sources, we also have more than five centuries of Unitarian history and more than two centuries of Universalist history, our own history and heritage beyond the world's religions that we can also draw on for support and inspiration that can inspire our work today and guide us as we seek to build a diverse, beloved community. And I've been thinking a lot about our Unitarian Universalist history and heritage in the past few months in preparation for the course that I'm co-teaching at Wesley Theological Seminary in D.C. on UU history and polity. Polity, think of the Greek word polis, like where we get politics, or it means city. So polity is just how we govern ourselves. You'll also know the politics comes from the ancient Greek word poly and tick, meaning many and blood-sucking creatures. No, it comes from polis. So, and while I will by no means try to make you sit through hours of lectures and the stacks of books that we require of our seminarians, although I do appreciate that some of you would actually find that to be a good time, as I do, I will be inviting you to experience a few more sermons than usual this winter and spring that are thematically linked to our UU history and heritage, because I want to share with you some about what I'm learning. And if history is not your favorite subject, there'll be plenty of other subjects covered this winter and spring. But my hope is that you'll increasingly see our UU history and heritage as a source of wisdom and guidance for us today. As Carol read earlier, we did not make ourselves. Indeed, we stand on the shoulders of giants. One reason that I'm starting this morning with Joseph Priestley is that we're in a subdivision here of the larger UUA known as the Joseph Priestley District. Now, to get a little nerdy about polity, we may actually not be the Joseph Priestley District for more than about two more years because we may merge into what's known as the Central East Regional Group, but setting that aside, for now, we are the Joseph Priestley District. And we named our district after Priestley because of his influence in spreading Unitarianism in this area, in particular in Pennsylvania. You heard, and of course, it didn't used to be D.C. was the capital, right? Philadelphia was an early major center. Although Priestley was raised a strict Calvinist in a strict Calvinist family, by his early 20s, he was a free-thinking minister-scientist. You don't hear that very often. He was a minister-scientist, unafraid to experiment with both theology and science in relatively the same way. If this sermon leaves you interested in learning more, there's a recent two-volume biography. I think the first volume was published maybe about a decade ago by Robert Schofield with Penn State University Press, but that weighs in at about 800 pages. Anybody read that? I'd be really surprised. All right, so that's kind of a doorstopper. A much more accessible introduction to Priestley is Stephen Johnson's The Invention of Air. Has anybody read that? I know. Okay, so quite a few of you have read that. That's only 200 pages aimed at a popular audience, so a really interesting read, The Invention of Air. And although Priestley's name is less well known today, he was quite influential in his own time. To give you just one example, President Adams and Jefferson famously had a falling out, but in the last little more than a decade of their life, they had a rapprochement and started exchanging letters and exchanged a total of 165 letters. You can read those. They're fascinating. In those 165 letters, Benjamin Franklin is mentioned by name 5 times. George Washington is mentioned 3 times. Their mutual nemesis, Alexander Hamilton, rates 2 mentions. By contrast, Priestley, an Englishman who only lived in this country in the last decade of his life, is mentioned 52 times. He was a figure of great fascination to both Adams and Jefferson and other founders of our country. And Priestley always wanted his insights shared widely. When the English scientist Isaac Newton, and this was fairly standard of that day, when he wrote his landmark book, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, known as the Principia, how many of us have heard of it in Latin, that was in 1687. In contrast, less than a century later, Priestley intentionally chose to publish his highly influential The History and Present State of Electricity, and with original experiments, he wrote in English because he wanted it to be widely accessible. He intentionally shaped his book. That's the reason he included both. He was really detailed about the experiments that had led in the history of electricity and his own experiments because he wanted people to see, you can do this too. And he also outlined, you know, this is the stuff that I know hasn't been done that somebody needs to do. He wanted people to read this history and be inspired to be scientists themselves, to advance the frontiers of knowledge. So Priestley was also fully transparent about his own discoveries and that they were really less a result of genius than just sheer persistent trial and error. He was sort of a kitchen sink scientist. He would just throw everything he could think of at a problem and see what weird things might happen that he could then pursue those trails. And speaking of experimentation without a guarantee of positive results, that famous story of Ben Franklin flying a kite in a thunderstorm, that comes from Priestley's History of Electricity. Franklin himself had published only a brief third-person account of that experiment in the Pennsylvania Gazette without specifying that he himself had performed it. But when Priestley went to write his History of Electricity, Franklin gladly gave him a lot more details. Unfortunately, Priestley's full transparency meant that he was a better scientist than he was an entrepreneur. For instance, he discovered a method for infusing carbonation into water. And think of the untold trillions of dollars that have come from the invention of soda water. Yet Priestley happily revealed his formula in letters, in pamphlets, at dinner party chatter to anyone who would listen. A certain Johann Schweppes fared better in this regard. Patenting a method of carbonating water in 1783. So you may have heard of Schweppes ginger ale or Schweppes tonic water. You have not heard of Priestley ginger ale. So Priestley's openness helped advance science, but was not always the best for his family's bank account. Now, there are many more fascinating details that can be traced about Priestley's scientific discoveries, but for this morning, allow me to focus on perhaps his most famous, what Johnson calls the invention of air. The story begins in childhood when, as an 11-year-old boy, Priestley discovered, as young children sometimes do, that if you trap an insect inside a sealed jar, that insect will die. Showing an early penchant for the scientific method and not having an ethics committee to answer to, the 11-year-old Priestley, in an effort to understand what precisely was happening, began closely observing how long it took different spiders to die when he sealed them up. This was around 1744, before either the American or French Revolution. And to appreciate the context, it's important to try to set aside all that we know about, you know, basic scientific insights here in the 21st century. At that time, no one knew. At that time, nobody knew why, when you sealed an insect inside a jar, it would die. Nobody knew why, if you sealed a lit candle inside a jar, it would snuff up. Did the creatures somehow exhaust the air they were breathing, in which case, what was left in the jar? Or were they poisoning the environment with some sort of invisible substance that they released, or was there some other factor at work? No one knew. Before Priestley, for the most part, people thought that the space between objects was simply sheer nothingness. And we know that's much more complex today. Fast forwarding almost 30 years, as an adult, Priestley picked back up on that line of experimentation that he had first begun as a child. The variation that occurred to him was to investigate that, what about if instead of a spider or a candle, he put a plant inside the jar? It was late spring, he pulled some mint from the garden, and he fully expected it. His hypothesis is that it would wilt and die within a matter of days. But something strange and unexpected happened. The plant stubbornly refused to die and continued growing all summer. For any young people here this morning, think of this as one of the best science fair project ideas ever. So simple, yet with profound results. The mysteries then began compounding. He found that if he put a candle in there with the jar, with the mint, it would keep burning. And although modern animal rights activists would not approve of the methods I'm about to tell you that Priestley next did, he also discovered that a mouse placed inside the jar with the plant could survive happily for about 10 minutes, whereas if you put a mouse in a plant-free jar in which a mouse had previously died, the new mouse would immediately start convulsing. So, fair warning, here endeth the animal cruelty portion of this morning's sermon. So the next insight Priestley had was to leave the mint plant sealed in a jar with a candle. And when the candle burned out, he knew that there was no more wholesome air in with the plant. But 10 days later, when he went to light another candle in that jar in the glass, it burned perfectly well. So it seemed that plants were restoring something fundamental to the air. They were perhaps creating the air itself. Excitingly, the results were the same when he repeated the experiment twice and three times. And he actually did it like 10 times before calling anyone. Johnson writes that with the 21st century universe story that we know that reaching back 13.8 billion years and reaching down to the level, the microscopic world of bacteria and molecules, that was almost entirely off limits to Priestley and to Franklin, who he often corresponded with. But both men, as he wrote back and forth with Franklin about this discovery, had a hunch that something profound was lurking in the mint's survival. We can see here the first stirrings of a genuinely new way of thinking about life on Earth and our role in that system, connecting to today with climate change. The air we breathe is not some inalienable fact of Earth. It has a history, unlike gravity or magnetism. Rather, the air we breathe is something that is specifically manufactured by plants, and that manufacture is a part of an interconnected system that links plants and animals and this invisible gases in a rational flow that can be systematized and traced and understood. And the choices we make as humans, Priestley and Franklin started to begin to understand, can have a dangerous impact on that flow. But of course, words like ecosystem weren't coined until like the 1930s. But as a result of Priestley's work, he was awarded the Copley Medal, the Nobel Prize of his day, by the Royal Society of London for, quote, "on account of the many curious and useful experiments confirmed in his exploration of different kinds of air." Now, I've spent a fair amount of time this morning tracing just one of Priestley's scientific discoveries, and I'll likely preach another sermon, it'll probably be a few years, on Priestley, telling you a little bit more about his life and his contribution to Unitarian theology. But part of my point for this morning is that the questions, the wonder, the scientific curiosity that Priestley brought to his exploration of the world, that is equally worthy of our reflection here on Sunday morning as his theological investigations. Along those lines, it's significant that Priestley brought the same scientific rigor and empiricism that he used in the laboratory, he wanted to apply that to politics and to theology as well. 2 years after his discovery of oxygen, in the introduction to his book on observations of air, he said that this rapid progress of knowledge will, I doubt not, be the means of extirpating all error and prejudice, and of putting an end to all undue and usurped authority in the business of religion as well as science. The English hierarchy, if there is anything also unsound in its constitution, has equal reason to tremble at the air pump or an electrical machine. Because these inventions, like the air pump or the electrical machine, they were showing the power of using reason and of experimenting and showing repeatable things that could actually be definitively proved as effective. And he thought you needed to apply that same process to religion and politics and other fields, that they must face the scrutiny of reason and firsthand experience. To briefly tell you some of the highlights on the religious side of his life, Priestley was a minister most of his life, somewhat intimidatingly. His scientific experiments, that was just what he did in his free time. Though I'm not actually sure how much time he spent being a minister, which is a separate discussion. But in 1774, 2 years after Priestley won that Copley Medal, when Theophilus Lindsley led the first Unitarian worship service in England, so what he did was he took the Book of Common Prayer and he took out all the Trinitarian references and led a Unitarian worship service. Of the 200 people in attendance at that first Unitarian service, among them were Benjamin Franklin, as well as Joseph Priestley. Almost a decade later, Priestley published a book titled History of the Corruptions of Christianity that criticized what he saw as later corruptions like the Trinity that distracted us from the point that he saw of Jesus' life and teachings as the original focus that we needed to get back to. That book helped inspire Thomas Jefferson. It was in his library that was donated to the Library of Congress. It inspired Jefferson to create the Jefferson Bible, where he cut out all the supernatural elements, the stuff that didn't hold up to reason and experience. Jefferson later wrote to Adams, I've read Priestley's Corruptions of Christianity and the Early Opinions of Jesus over and over again, and I rest on them. They are the basis of my faith. These writings have never been answered. Each week, I begin our service by saying that we seek to draw wisdom from all the world's religions, balanced with the insights of modern science. Our theological ancestors, such as Priestley, can be vital inspirations for us today and for future generations as we seek to live ever more fully into the promise of our fourth principle, the free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And as we seek to live fully into our fifth source, humanist teachings that counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science. The Greek root of the word heretic simply means to choose. It means someone who chooses for him or herself what to believe instead of allowing a hierarchy or a religious tradition to choose for you. A heretic is someone who just says, no, I'm going to choose for myself, not what is chosen secondhand. Priestley died in 1804 at the age of 70, but before then, his old friend Benjamin Franklin wrote in a letter to a mutual acquaintance, "Remember me affectionately to the honest heretic, Dr. Priestley. Do not, however, mistake me. It is not to my good friend's heresy that I impute his honesty. On the contrary, 'tis his honesty that has brought upon him the character of a heretic." It is his honesty, his demand that we rely not on what others have told us allegedly is the truth, but that we test for ourselves what the truth actually is. That's what made Priestley an honest heretic. The character of a heretic, the character of one who demands to choose for him or herself. May it be so for us that when faced with secondhand information that we discover to be untrue. You can think most famously in our own time, most recently, when people said, you know, what's going to happen if we legalize same-sex marriage? That's going to endanger, you know, opposite-sex marriage. And if we, you know, let lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender citizens of this country, you know, adopt children, they're going to, you know, corrupt those children. What we've now seen in our own firsthand empirical experience is that is a load of bunk. Those were canards. They were lies. And that's, but, you know, so they're saying we don't care what, you know, that if it comes down between what Scripture says thousands of years ago and what we can prove through our reason and experience, that's what we're going to go with, and that's going to make us an honest heretic. So may we, when we discover information that is untrue, that has been told to us secondhand, maybe listen to that still, small voice of our conscience and be honest to what we know is true in the crucible of our firsthand experience. May the honest heretics that shaped our living tradition be the legacy that we also leave to future generations. May we choose for ourselves with integrity and with authenticity. And as we continue to reflect on this standing on the shoulders of giants and living in this tension between firsthand and secondhand knowledge and between the wisdom of the world's religions balanced with the insights of modern science, I invite you to rise, embody your spirit, as we sing together hymn 298, Wake Now My Senses, verses 1 through 3. One of the most interesting parts of studying Unitarian Universalist history is seeing the echoes over time that sort of recapitulate themselves in different eras. And about 200 years before Joseph Priestley in the 1500s, another minister scientist, I'm obviously a slacker in the scientific half of my job title apparently, Michael Servetus. So he was born in 1511, or Miguel Servito, who was born in Spain. He was born in 1511, so that's 6 years before 1517, which is when Luther nailed the 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg Chapel and inspired the Protestant Reformation. So Servetus was one of those people who read the Bible for himself and discovered, wait, the word Trinity is not in the Bible. All these people are arguing about Greek words. So the New Testament was written in Greek. That all these people are arguing about words like homoousios. So there was what was called the great vowel debate at Nicaea. Is it homoousios or homoiousios? Is there an I in there or not? Which means, is it same substance? So homo is same, ousios is substance. Are Jesus and God of the same substance, or are they of similar substance? And he's like, neither of those words are in the Bible. Why are we fighting about this? Why are we letting this keep Jews and Christians and Muslims apart? You know, why can't the Trinity just be an optional belief? Why are we saying it's a core belief? So this is the sort of stuff Servetus was writing. And then he got in a lot of trouble. And so he changed his name and went to medical school in France. And he was a minister scientist, right? So he was doing, you know, still preaching some, exploring theology, but he was also dissecting human bodies on the side. And back then, the paradigm that he was operating under was still basically the same as the Greek's physician Galen back in the 200s. And what people thought, including Servetus, continued to think this, is that the blood came from the liver. So that they thought the liver continually produced blood, and that it was then absorbed by the nutrients of the body, and then the liver would make more blood. And what Servetus discovered through firsthand experience, through dissection, was he discovered the true course of pulmonary circulation. So he realized, they used to think that the blood was oxygenated in the left ventricle. And what he did was actually trace it and discover that, no, it went through the lungs, and so he traced that. But here's the interesting part about being a minister scientist, is that he published that discovery in Christiani Restitutio, his book, The Restoration of Christianity. So he, in that book, there was a section about the truth of and his findings about pulmonary circulation. So it's completely intertwined, you know, religion and theology, and approaching them both the same way, and just just totally combined. And then, of course, Servetus was famously martyred. He was killed by John Calvin. He was executed in Geneva. He was cruelly burned at the stake. It took about 30 minutes because they used green wood. His books were burned. And he was killed for being anti-Trinitarian and being an anti-Pado Baptist, which meant he thought that you should be baptized as an adult. You shouldn't do children. So Calvin killed him for that. One of Calvin's very low moments, though Geneva was a sort of a military state under Calvin, but that's a separate story. So, but it's interesting to see how Servetus and both Priestley, these echoes of these sort of this intertwinement of science and theology that continues to today. So as you go from this place and as you think about this legacy that we've inherited and continue to extend, continue your journey walking in love. Care for one another and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, know that whatever taste or touch of hope, of love, of peace or joy that you've experienced in this time and place, that goes with you out into the world. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.